do you remember the 28th of April, Sunday the 28th of April?
No, I don't. Was that the day I suppose everyone's talking about?
The worst crime in Australia's history. It seemed that he wanted to go out with a bang.
This is where it all started.
There's somebody going crazy, shooting people.
It was a disaster.
There he is, he's over there.
You would pull the trigger with your finger on your left hand.
Yeah, that's right.
All right.
Without the gun in his hands. He was a nobody.
That's your gun.
That's a shotgun.
This is the way.
That's a sweet little gun.
He went there to kill people.
Massacred. Slaughtered.
Christ, what's this fellow going to be like? Am I his next victim? It's a nightmare. A nightmare that continues. A nightmare for Australia.
What else is it?
Australia was scarred forever by the horrors at Port Arthur 20 years ago. Tonight, for the first time, the mystery and mythology that's developed around mass murderer Martin Bryant will come crashing down. You'll be able to see him for what he is, as we see the killer questioned at length for the very first time. Hello, I'm Melissa Doyle. Welcome to Sunday Night. 35 people died when Bryant ran amok with his arsenal of weapons at the busy tourist destination of Port Arthur in Tasmania. This appalling crime wounded many more, scarred the nation, shocked the world, and changed us forever. It prompted a Prime Minister to disarm Australia, and thankfully we've not seen such bloodshed since. We've also never seen or heard from Bryant himself. And in that vacuum, he's become an enigma. Like many grotesque criminals locked away out of sight, he's become larger than life. Tonight, his lawyer, his psychiatrist, and his girlfriend will break their silence to reveal new insights into the criminal mind of Australia's worst mass murderer. But even more revealing is the video of the police interrogation of Bryant. It's never been shown outside court. For some of you, this will no doubt bring back painful memories. A little later tonight, we will pay tribute to the victims of the Port Arthur massacre. But we hope tonight's program will help us all better understand one of our darkest days. Mike Willacy leads our special investigation.
When you practiced your shooting, where did you hold the gun?
On my left.
So you're left-handed?
I'm right with this hand.
Oh, that's right, sorry. Yeah.
This is my...
So if you held a gun, you would pull the trigger with your finger on your left hand?
Yeah, that's right.
All right. And did you ever practice shooting from the hip?
No, never.
Never?
To the Port Arthur historic site.
My name is Paul, I'm your guide for the next 40 minutes, and what I'm aiming to do is give you an overview of the history here at Port Arthur.
Martin, do you remember the 28th of April, Sunday the 28th of April this year?
No, I don't. Was that the day I suppose everyone's talking about?
That's a shotgun.
That's a shotgun.
Stay inside. I'm pretty sure someone's got a gun.
In fact, you're bloody positive of it.
There's somebody going crazy shooting people here.
Oh.
You know what's happened on that day?
What's happened?
28th of April. You don't? I'm sure about that.
Positive. Oh. There he is. He's over there. Can't believe it.
Any idea who he was?
No idea. Not a local, I don't think.
Any idea why?
No idea.
Everyone, ducking for cover, Randy.
It's getting into a yellow car.
Into the bushes, Nolan.
How many people died altogether? Including the people at Seascape.
35.
And there's
people injured too. Many?
Well,
approximately 20.
That's the first ambulance. In about 35 minutes.
I cannot understand. He did not say one word. He never ran. He walked everywhere, just shooting people.
We all know the crime, the staggering scale of it, the awful loss of life. But the person responsible is an enigma, seen but never heard. We are about to change all that.
I thought, Christ, what's this fellow going to be like? Is he Hannibal Lecter-like? Is he just plain evil?
Representing Martin Bryant, his new lawyer, John Avery, appointed after Bryant had pleaded not guilty 6 weeks ago.
And like the man who got to know him best at the time, you'll be able to form a very clear picture of this infamous individual. With the help of never-before-seen police video, hand drawings of the murder scene by Bryant himself, and the inside account from his lawyer, we'll seek to discover how and why this horror happened, and who Martin Bryant really is.
In your own words, you went there for that first meeting with a sense of trepidation. Yeah, I did. It was pretty soon dispelled, I might say, when he was wheeled in a wheelchair with his legs manacled and handcuffed and with a big grin on his face like a big schoolboy. I didn't any longer see any connection with Hannibal Lecter.
Martin, it's not funny. I can't explain anything because I don't know anything about keys or...
But it's not funny, is it?
What is it?
This what I'm talking about. So why do you laugh?
Because it's good to get out of myself.
Why are you speaking now?
It's a way of me finally putting the Martin Bryant saga behind me. It's been around in some ways for so long that hopefully now I can bury it.
Back in the 80s, a younger Martin Bryant wandered the streets of Hobart selling rabbits to his neighbours. At the time, John Avery was a young lawyer and lived with his wife around the corner from Bryant.
I didn't realise that there was any connection, but he quickly told me, oh, do you still live in that big house with an oak tree in the front, and does your wife drive a Holden station wagon, and do you drive a white Mercedes? I said, yeah. And we got talking. I went home and I said to my wife, do we know this fellow? Oh, yes, she said, don't you remember? He used to come around as a little boy selling rabbits around the neighbourhood, and I'd never let him in the door because he'd peer around like he wanted to see what was inside.
That small connection would help John Avery years later when he was called on to be Bryant's lawyer and needed to build trust.
I thought that was the thread I needed, that somewhat personal contact, to hold on to him through this process. And rightly or wrongly, I used it.
But didn't it frighten you to think this man has killed more than 30 people, injured more than that?
No, it didn't frighten me once I saw him, because I could see that without the gun, without the weapon, he was nothing. He was a nobody. He was a sad, insipid little boy.
We've got some of your guns here. Mr. Warren might hold them up. And we'll perhaps talk about each one individually. That might be the best way, but...
It's big. Is it loaded?
No, it's not loaded.
You're not loaded, Martin, I'll tell you.
To understand how Bryant had become a cold-blooded killer, Avery needed to get inside his head. He hired forensic psychiatrist Professor Paul Mullen.
All that was required to get him talking and keep him talking was to show an interest.
It was all about him?
Yes, absolutely all about him. Bryant was a good-looking young man, blonde, blue-eyed, handsome. childlike. One of the problems, I think, throughout Bryant's life is that he looked an attractive kid, he looked an attractive adolescent, he looked an attractive adult. He also looked an intelligent kid, an intelligent adolescent, and an intelligent adult, but he wasn't. So people who met him had expectations of what he'd be able to say and do and how he'd react, which he couldn't live up to.
The photos we have of Bryant's childhood don't appear to show anything out of the ordinary. He grew up in this house with his mum and dad and a little sister. When he was 12, he made the local TV news after injuring himself with fireworks.
Do you think you'll be playing with firecrackers anymore?
Yes.
Don't you think you've learned a lesson from this?
Yes, but I'm still playing with it.
This was a dim child who didn't look dim. This was a kiddie who struggled in lots of ways from a very early stage. I mean, I think his parents almost certainly did the best they could. I mean, he has a sister who grew up perfectly normally. I think incompetent or abusive or terrible about his parenting, there was nothing at all deprived or damaging about his family background. It was the nature of this dim, irritable boy who people really, no one could manage well.
Hey, Martin, how come you never got around to getting a driver's license?
Oh, I didn't think I'd ever pass.
At school, he was knocked around, and he in turn learned to knock around.
I'm not sure which came first. He was certainly would get angry and frustrated and lash out at people at school. And, of course, other children found him odd and difficult. He was never placed in the kind of special schooling that would have been appropriate for someone of his intellectual or lack of intellectual abilities, partly, I suspect, again, because his appearance. He looked so good.
Bryant was a loner. He struggled to fit in. He dropped out of school before turning 16.
He told you, all I wanted was for people to like me.
And that, in a sense, was where his rage came from. He couldn't understand why people didn't like him. Couldn't understand why people moved away from him. He believed that this was because they were malicious, had it in for him, and it was all terribly, terribly unfair.
But Bryant did strike up an unexpected friendship with this woman, Helen Harvey, an heir to the Tattersalls' lottery fortune. She died in a mysterious car accident. Bryant was also in the car and suffered a serious neck injury. She left him two properties and more than $500,000.
She died and left him rich.
She left him very rich indeed.
How did that affect him?
I think it was a disaster. He thought with that would come friends and would come girlfriends and would come a social life and all these things. Well, what came with it, of course, was people willing to exploit him and certainly take him on short term to get what they could out of him.
I said I wasn't interested in the money. I was more interested in what he had to offer as a person.
In 1995, a year before the Port Arthur massacre, Mary was Bryant's girlfriend. She asked us to hide her identity. They were together for 8 months and took several holidays interstate.
I remember we were in a restaurant in Sydney and he was looking at the age or something and I could tell he wasn't really reading it. I don't think he was that smart. He was only just pretending to try and impress me. And I remember smiling at him and pretending and going along with it to make him feel good about himself, like he, you know, he could be smart. He was smart in some ways, but in some ways not very smart.
On another date, Bryant took her for a boat ride. They ran out of petrol and were stranded for hours.
And I started crying. He started crying. Yeah. He started crying. He thought that was it. He thought we were going to die. I was hanging on to some hope that something might drift somewhere.
So In this boating mishap, Martin Bryant was crying because he thought he might die.
Yes.
Seems strange against all the evidence of him going in and shooting all these people where he told some people that he thought he would either die or get captured. But he did it without crying.
I think he was genuinely remorseful that he got me in that situation too. Maybe he was just staring at me and he felt guilty.
Mary was 16. Bryant was 27. Despite their age difference, Bryant was serious about the relationship.
Did he ask you to marry him?
He did ask me to marry him, yeah.
What did you say?
I was honest with him. I didn't think he was too smart.
Did he love you?
Yeah, I think so.
Was he capable of love?
Yes, yeah.
Now, this is a .223 Remington.
It's a mess.
Oh, Colt AR-15. And do you remember how much you paid for that one?
$5,000 with the scope. $5,000 with the scope.
Bryant had been planning a massacre for several months. 2 weeks before the shootings, he went into a department store with a new girlfriend, Petra Wilmot, and purchased a sports bag. He measured it to make sure it was large enough to carry his stash of weapons.
Seen that before? Well, I believe he bought that in Myers or Fitzgerald or somewhere in town, accompanied with a young woman.
Among the guns inside the bag was one similar to this.
This is a serious weapon, a Colt AR-15, a semi-automatic assault rifle. It's one of three types of weapons that Bryant took to Port Arthur that day. In the cafe, using a rifle just like this, he took 15 seconds to kill 12 people and wound 10. 15 seconds, as measured by a tape recording by a tourist. 15 seconds of fun and excitement for Bryant. 15 seconds of immeasurable tragedy for the victims and their families. And there was more to come.
That's a shotgun.
That's a shotgun.
The others sound like a 3-hour.
See that man running there? Yeah. Going past the green building up here. He just came out of the building.
Day trippers, holiday makers and tourists, young and old, massacred by a lone gunman.
When the gunfire stopped, 35 people were dead, 23 injured.
What would you think about a person who has killed 35 people? What would you be your opinion of that person?
That's a wicked, awful, horrendous thing. I don't know.
And you won't?
And they reckon others were injured.
There were many injured. There was two little babies killed, shot. There have been many witnesses who have given very graphic description of you being responsible for killing those
it
people.
It is sad, isn't it? It's horrendous in the words of with anyone to go down there and do a thing like that. Mrs. Jones.
Thank you,
I wish I had that AR-15 in here. Wouldn't I could probably get out. Jump out the window. I could probably jump through the window and escape because of prison. I don't like being locked up. It's not very nice.
Martin Bryant had been planning the Port Arthur attacks for months. He even circled the 28th of April on his calendar. The night before, he spent here with his girlfriend Petra.
Did you set the alarm clock when you went to bed?
No, I never usually set the alarm clock.
Police believe that Bryant didn't normally use his alarm clock, but he set it for 6 a.m. that day.
They got up, took a shower together, then sat down for breakfast.
We had breakfast, like we usually do, and then I haven't had a shower together. had breakfast. Then I said, Petra, I'll see you on Monday.
His girlfriend Petra said that she had no idea of what he was planning, and she said she left at 8.
In the next hour or so, Bryant drank from a bottle of Sambuca while he gathered his weapons and ammunition.
He set his house security alarm at 9:47.
What did you do?
I went surfing. I went surfing for
Though Bryant took his surfboard, he did not go to a beach. He'd loaded 2 semi-automatic guns and a shotgun. In his yellow Volvo, he headed towards Port Arthur.
Stop anywhere on the way?
I think I stopped and got a cappuccino, yes, at Sorrel.
In fact, Bryant made 4 stops on the way. Here, at Midway Point, to buy a cigarette lighter. He got a coffee in Fawcett, petrol at Tirana, and in Sorrel, he bought tomato sauce.
Buy any tomato sauce on the way down?
No tomato sauce.
Oh, I don't know.
This was part of a bizarre game Bryant was playing with police, admitting to only small parts of the truth. At first, he also lied to his lawyer, John Avery, claiming he didn't go to Port Arthur.
And I said, look, Martin, that's just bullshit. That doesn't sit with anything that we know. I think his response was he laughed his head off and then pretty much gave me a complete confession that was consistent with the evidence as I knew it.
That laughing is a recurring theme. Many people would think, well, he's nuts, he's insane.
Yeah, look, I never thought of it like that. It was a girlish giggle. It was at times uncontrollable. It was a mannerism that maybe he was getting pleasure out of what he was relating. I don't know.
Bryant also took strange pleasure in drawing the horror he had unleashed.
Is he the figure in black shooting?
He's the figure in black shooting, and the victims are those in red. It paints a pretty chilling version of events from which it's impossible to escape the conclusion that he's certainly admitting full responsibility for what happened.
So he was happy about all this?
When they were handed to me, I said gleefully, I think it was an element of bragging in handing them over and showing what he'd done.
The drawings are a step-by-step account of how the murders went down. He parked his Volvo at the Seascape guest house. He confronted David and Sally Martin, killing the couple and leaving them on their bed. Bryant had wanted to buy another property they owned nearby on Lighthouse Road. Avery learned that this was what triggered the massacre that day.
He had a long grudge against them, but he told me, and I'll just quote his own words, I'd tried to buy the farm off them before and offered them a lot of money, but Mrs. Martin would say to me, I'm never going to sell it. It doesn't matter how much money you offer me, Martin. So I shot them in the head.
So, true or false, he had some sort of a reason for shooting the Martins, killing the Martins, but why the other people?
Well, I think he realised and or thought that he would either be killed himself or at least go to jail for a very long time, and he thought, I might as well go out in a big way, kill as many as I can.
Bryant's most detailed sketch was of the Broad Arrow Cafe.
He made it clear that he started by sitting around here, and then maybe while he was sitting, he killed probably 2 people at the next table. Then he walked across here. It's quite chilling to be here seeing his sketch and knowing what he did. Came over here and killed 2 people. Came back, And then he saw a bunch of tables, maybe eight tables. He called three at one table, three here. Then he makes it quite clear, specifically, he takes only short steps and he calls another six people. And the word that keeps coming back to me is how cold and completely lacking in compassion. It's hard to get your mind around that. He then heads towards the exit. He's about to leave, but he sees somebody else. So he shoots and kills that person. And then he leaves the Broad Arrow cafeteria.
The crayon drawings from Bryant illustrate his next move, the people he killed in and around the buses in the car park.
There's somebody going crazy shooting people here. There he is. He's over there. I can't believe it.
Then came the cold-blooded killing of Nanette Mikak and her children, Alana and Madeline. They approached Bryant's car on this stretch of road, not knowing he was the killer. Nanette pleaded for the lives of her children.
It seemed all right.
And the mother saying, please don't hurt my children.
And almost as if to spite her, he kills them both. One runs behind the tree as if to escape him, but all in vain.
He chases her.
Chases her and kills her. It's pretty chilling.
He's driven up to the entrance gate.
This sketch illustrates where Bryant went next, stopping his car at a toll booth where he killed four people in a BMW. He then stole the car and drove to a service station where he killed a woman and forced her boyfriend, Glenn Pears, into the boot of the BMW. The kidnapping was the only crime Bryant admitted to police.
I saw this car ride by, and killed up the person in the car, kidnapped him.
How did this guy get in the boot?
I put him in the boot because I had the gun.
Which gun did you have?
I had the
Mr. Warren Holder.
AR-15. See, if people didn't do these unfortunate things, you guys wouldn't have a job.
Well, there's a lot of truth in that, Mark, let me tell you.
That one there?
Yes.
That was the one.
This is the one.
And it's a sweet little gun. It's so light. How light is it?
Yeah. Can you remember what you said to this fellow?
Hey, mate, get out of your car, please. I'm going to take your car.
And you had this pointed at him, did you?
Yeah, I had it pointed at him. And moving backwards and forwards with his wife and child.
Bryant's final act was to drive Glenn Pears to the Seascape guesthouse, where, during an all-night siege with police, he shot him. His 35th murder.
You've written that when he unloaded and finally told you the truth about what he'd done, he was thrilled.
Yeah, I asked him whether there was any excitement. He evidenced to me that it was as thrilling as driving a car at high speed or a speedboat. So there was certainly that aspect of thrill-seeking that he appears to have achieved in this horrible day.
In the police interview, there was one moment where Bryant dropped his guard. He thought they'd stopped recording.
I'm sure you'll find the person that calls. I don't find that a very funny statement at all, mate, to be quite honest.
You shouldn't put that on recording.
Oh, it's still recording at this present stage, so that is on recording.
When Martin Bryant first appeared here in the Supreme Court of Tasmania, he had long blonde hair. Bizarrely, he pleaded not guilty.
You want to see these photos, not very pleasant.
Police had tried over a period of months to convince Bryant to tell the truth. In July 1996, Bryant was even shown images of the crime scenes at Port Arthur.
There's the Broad Arrow Cafe. Okay. You can see a couple of people lying there.
He was shown photographs of each of 35 victims. The investigators hoped seeing the horror he had caused might elicit compassion, even a confession.
And you've written on... Yep.
It did not.
Seen enough.
Was he scared about his situation?
No.
Was he enjoying it?
Oh, absolutely.
Where does it say how many people were killed?
He was absolutely interested in the fact that he was not only the talk of Hobart and Tasmania, but at least for a short time, national interest.
And he enjoyed that, I gather.
I think he reveled in it.
Yeah, you're convinced now that there are 35 people dead.
I know that you weren't pressuring him, but it was a big thing in what you were trying to do, was to get him to plead guilty to all charges.
It seemed to me from day one that the evidence was so overwhelming and the outcome of a trial would have been so obvious that I was trying to avoid a show trial, a circus, a pantomime, call it what you like, because that would have been an absolute stupidity. But it also involved having all these witnesses, damaged people, come to court and have to give evidence where the outcome was always inevitable.
I've told you what you've done. What have I done? You've killed 35 people.
And injured several others.
Bryant got to a stage early on in my dealings with him that he was going to plead guilty to the murders. But we had a uniquely unusual situation where he wanted to plead not guilty to the attempted murders.
Why? Well, I mean, there's no legal rationale for that.
No, but the stupidity of it was, I think, that what he wanted was the people who he'd so grievously maimed, he wanted them to come to court and say it was him. He wanted to be the centre of attention.
He wanted to be seen as powerful and evil. Some of the early news coverage, which portrayed him as demonic, exactly what he wanted, delighted him.
So, was he crazy?
No.
Mad?
No. I mean, he's mad in the everyday sense of the word. He did something that none of us can, almost none of us can even get our heads around imagining, let alone doing. But no, he did not have a serious mental illness. He did not have schizophrenia. He was of very low IQ. He was borderline to subnormal. His IQ was lower than over 98% of the general population, so he's a very dim man.
Bryant was very sensitive to suggestions he had a low IQ, and Avery realised he might be able to use this sensitivity to encourage him to plead guilty. It was the killer's Achilles heel.
I said, mate, you're going to be made look stupid. They'll say, simple Martin, simple fellow. this is a nonsense, running this type of trial where you just want people to stand and point to you and say, yes, this is the man who shot Assis. You know, the next time I saw him, he'd changed his mind. He said, I'll plead guilty to everything.
He also decided to write a confession. Avery has kept it for all these years. This is the first time it has ever been shown.
So he wrote it this size?
Absolutely.
I, Martin Bryant, wish to plead guilty to all charges, 72. I wish my lawyer to tell the court that I want to change my plea from not guilty to guilty.
Yep, well, there it is, dated and signed.
Historic document, sad.
Yeah.
The 72 charges were read one by one, and he pleaded guilty 72 times.
Well, I held my breath, I've got to say, till every one of those 72 charges were read and the plea entered.
When he came back for sentencing, he had changed again. His hair was cut short. And so was his freedom, forever.
Bryant was ordered to serve 35 life sentences, 1,035 years without parole.
What was the first thing he said to you after the sentence, Jill?
Well, he said he'd like to have another can of Pepsi.
Really?
And did he? Could he?
Yeah, and I shared it with him.
Avery had finished his job but now carried with him an overwhelming burden. He'd got too close to a mass murderer.
I said to myself, am I his next victim? Have I been drawn into his web? Is he playing with my mind while I'm trying to get inside his?
What do you mean? I should be out. I should be out. If I could get out on bail tomorrow, I'd pay the money.
Why do you reckon you should be out, though?
Because it's not fair on me, is it? I mean, I know I've done the wrong thing, but surely they can train me for a few months a year for what I've done. We can work things out.
So there's a constant theme here of Bryant wanting notoriety.
Notoriety and ringmaster in the circus. He wanted to be the fellow who had committed the worst crime in Australia's history and top of the class.
By pleading guilty to 72 charges, including 35 murders, Martin Bryant accomplished his sick goal. He even appeared to take pleasure in his multiple life sentences.
In his usual way, he said something probably quite inappropriate. He said he was happy with the sentence, but I think he meant it was appropriate.
For John Avery, defending Bryant had been a punishing experience. At 5 a.m., the day after the sentencing, he sat alone in his office with the lights off and recorded his thoughts.
I thought I could easily walk away and get on with life, but I think perhaps I have been touched by him like his victims. Why am I so caught up in this whole matter? Why can't I get him out of my mind, and why do I continue to feel guilty that I can't feel that I hate him? Why do I feel sorry for him? Has he made me famous, or am I really just basking in his fame and nothing more than his alter ego? Why did I step away from the question of whether I was his friend and say I was his lawyer, when indeed I know I have become his friend and the lawyer part has been little? I'm crying and I don't know why. How could a client do this to me? How could someone rob me of myself? Martin Bryant, I won't let you beat me. I won't become your next victim. Whew. Yeah, that's how I felt. And 20 years later, it's... Yeah, it's probably still how I feel.
You haven't shaken him off?
Let's hope I can after this.
Though he makes no excuses now, defending Bryant may well have contributed to the path John Avery took next. He embezzled $500,000 from his law firm to buy art, a passion that became an addiction. He served 4 years in jail and was disbarred as a lawyer.
I've come out the other end. It's been a struggle at times, but you get on with life, you take the knocks and you move on.
It's been very courageous of you to be so honest.
Oh, I don't think so. I think, as I said, those 4 years in jail, at times I hated myself. I'd been on a course of self-destruct. I put my legal career in jeopardy. I'd put my marriage in jeopardy. I'd totally fucked up. Fortunately, I've got what's best and still got it. So I don't think it's courageous. It's probably just at last wanting to do the right thing.
Hardly a day goes by when Avery doesn't think about Bryant, how bad it was and how much worse it could have been.
Did he express any views about wanting to kill more people?
Yeah, regrettably he did, yeah. On a few occasions.
So not only no remorse, but he wished he'd killed more.
I don't think he understood the concept of remorse. I mean, if I said to him, as I did a couple of occasions, look, you really should be sorry for what you did, his response would be, oh, well, I'm sorry then, aren't I?
And Bryant wasn't even sorry about spending the rest of his life behind bars.
So the overall idea of prison didn't deter him or frighten him at all. He just wanted to be with the big boys.
I think he thought he'd be lauded by them. I mean, that was exactly the opposite of what would have happened, in my view, but... he continued to protest, no, they'll like me, they'll get on with me.
Bryant was wrong. He is an outcast inside, just as he was on the outside. Last year, these press photographs emerged.
Martin Bryant has been locked up here in Risdon Prison for 20 lonely years, protected from other prisoners and protected from himself after suicide attempts. He's overweight and lost. Martin Bryant wanted to die, but not as slowly and as miserably as this.
Mike Willacy reporting. Mick O'Donnell and Debbie Marshall were the producers. Tonight's special edition of Sunday Night has generated a great deal of debate online. The Port Arthur atrocity still commands significant public interest. Playing the interview in court at the time, the prosecution argued it demonstrated Bryant was capable of fielding questions and that, quote, his responses and demeanour showed complete lack of remorse. As we approach the 20th anniversary, we believe it's time the Australian public should also witness Bryant's only interview about his appalling crimes. The enormity of Martin Bryant's crimes are not something that words can adequately describe. So we'll leave you tonight with the faces and names of those whose lives were senselessly cut short 20 years ago.